You just came in. I started at 003. I'll wait till you went to start. Edris, do you want to start asking about... I was sort of on question 7. I was following courtship and marriage and Sydney. No. You can start now.
All right. The musicians that Sydney lived with, were these all people from Pittsburgh Symphony?
Yes, and all mostly from New York.
And how long did you date before you got married?
Let's see. We were married in 1940, and I first knew him in 1937. So it must have been several years. Right.
Why didn't you get married right away? Is there any reason?
Sydney was never sure. He was a man who couldn't make up his mind about a lot of things. He always wanted to leave a door open. Oh, he always told the story about even that how I dragged him up the steps at the city county building when we went for our license, and he still didn't want to get married. And no, he was unsure. I don't remember why. First of all, he was in no position to get married, and he earned so little money. But I don't think that was it. I think he just was not sure that he wanted to get married. And his poor mother in New York was so concerned that her Cinderella didn't find the right girl, and she did a little investigating herself to be sure. No, I think that was probably the reason. It was just that he was not sure. I guess I wasn't sure either. But it was more uncertainty on his
part.
How
old was Sydney when he got married?
Sydney was 25.
And how old were you?
28. I was 3 years older than him.
Oh.
Yeah, all was wise.
How did your family feel about you marrying him?
Well, actually, my father died 6 months before we got married. My mother wasn't living. My sister, you didn't know my sister, did you? I think she was happy with the idea. My brothers were that much older, and some of them were living away, and they really weren't involved, too much involved with my personal life.
Did you continue to work at the symphony after
for 17? Yes. I worked for them for 17 years. I worked until 51. So I was married in 1940 and worked until 1951.
During those years, I imagine you met many interesting people. And did you find, because of your connection with the symphony, that you entertained a lot?
Yes, we entertained in our home very modestly at first, and then a little more lavishly. But I would say, well, I really have a list of everybody that's been to my home, and it's quite a list. Everybody from home.
Can you remember one of the first parties or things that you had to do and how you felt about it? Or some of the interesting people in those days that came?
Well, Isaac Stern, we entertained for him almost every year, whenever he would come to Pittsburgh for many years. We had a tiny apartment at the corner of Center, and, oh, Fritz Reiner came to our little wee one-bedroom apartment. It was with a Pullman kitchen at Center and Melwood Street above Finkel Pearl's drugstore. And we made roast duck in the Pullman kitchen.
Wow.
And then we had a party when Victor De Sabata was here, and we had a party for him in that same little apartment. He was a world-renowned conductor from Italy.
How many people came to
this? That was, well, with Reiner, we only had another couple because it was a small, but with De Sabata, we had about 12 people in the room. That was not dinner. That was a little supper. In those days, we did it all very modestly, and it was mostly other musicians that would come. Then when we moved to the Ambassador Apartments, we had a little more elegant.
We had the Ambassador
on Center Avenue also, down near Neville Street. Mm-hmm. Trying to think who came to that house.
Was Sydney personnel manager?
Not in those years. I can't remember exactly the year. I have it all down someplace, but I'd have to dig it out for you. I can't remember exactly what year he became personal manager. Oh, who shall I say? Claudia Rao was here in this house. Pinky Zuckerman was, not Pinky was here too, but Itzhak Perlman was here, came up the steps on his crutches with his mother before he ever got married, when he made his first appearance in Pittsburgh. We didn't get him here. Paul Paré. I don't think we ever had Milstein to our home.
Do you remember any interesting anecdotes about any?
Well,
were they warm and
Piatigorsky was here in this house with his wife, Madame Rothschild. That was an interesting anecdote because she was very timid person, very withdrawn. And at that time, she was a great chess player and was very interested in chess. And at that time, Carl, my son, was, I can't remember what age, he was less than 10 years old, but he was playing chess. Carl Kritz was the assistant conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony at that time, and he was a chess player. So my son Carl woke up, and Carl Kritz went back and started to play chess with Carl. Up until that moment, Mrs. Piatigorsky hardly spoke to a person. She just kind of stood back. When she heard there was chess going on in the back bedroom, she went back, and it was as though the world opened up. She became an entirely different person, and she stayed back there with them and monitored the chess game and told Carl what to do. And that was one interesting. I guess there were many other things, but they just don't come to mind.
You mentioned your son, Carl. Do you have any other children?
No, just Carl. Just Carl. I had him rather late in life, and he kept me awake at night often enough.
When you say late in life, what?
Well, late in life. When other people were worried about having babies, and it was a bit of a risk. Everybody was worried about me, but I wasn't. I was in a great mood, and that was great. But anyway, he's now 29 years old and a lawyer.
We came to see where?
Buchanan Ingersoll wrote a wild collie in Berger, a Jewish mother's dream.
Did you find it difficult raising a child with the his father on tour? I imagine that Sidney being with the symphony wasn't home.
Well, I just happened to talk to mention something to somebody today. Whenever his father would go on tour was when he got some kind of illness. It always, and this seemed to be so with most of the other young mothers who had symphony wives, the minute their husbands go out of town, the kids got sick with one thing or another, and that was Carl's. And so I always had him to myself when he was ill. Of course, he would get ill sometimes when his father was home, too. But the one great thing about having an irregular schedule, the father having an irregular schedule, is that a child gets to spend much more time with his father than the average child. The father is home during the day. He's very often out in the evenings, but he's home during the day. We got to spend all of our summers completely together at Chautauqua, where we went all summer long. And they really could have fun together, had much more time to have fun together than most children.
What kind of things did they do together?
Well, golfing mainly.
Even when Carl was little?
When Carl was about 13 years old. When Carl was real little, I took care of his amusements. He was crazy about trains, and we went regularly to the East Liberty Station to watch the trains. Regularly. And I took care of buying his train set and going shopping with him. My husband didn't get too much involved with those things, but as he got a little bit older. But he did feed him, gave him his bottles when he was an infant.
Is Carl musically inclined?
Not really. I don't think he certainly has been exposed to it, and I have a feeling he likes it, but he has no inclination at all for it.
Did you ever encourage music lessons?
Yes. We started out with the clarinet, with the recorder, which he did all right with. Every child does fine with the recorder. And then I asked him what he wanted to do, and of course the clarinet was always the most popular instrument. All the boys wanted to play clarinet. But that was very unsuccessful. He hated to practice, and we would settle for half an hour, and then soon we would settle for 25 minutes, and it got down to 5 minutes, and finally it was a disaster. So we quit.
How did Sydney feel about this?
He had no desire to push it at all. Absolutely. It didn't matter to him. I always thought he was going to be a singer because he had a lovely voice as a child, always was singing, always in pitch. And I did take him to a singing teacher when he was about 14, but he was really not interested in that. And I think he likes music, but he has no sitz fleisch. He can't sit anywhere. He can't sit. No, he really can't. He hates to be locked in to be sure that if he goes to a concert, he's got to sit. I think he must go. He goes to things like that with his dates now. Well, with me, if I couldn't get a sitter and I wanted to go to a concert during the day, I'd bribe him with candy or whatever. He'd bother the life out of me, but I insisted that he go with me. But that didn't do any good. He really, I don't think it, but he's been, the music's been in the air all around him,
sure,
all his life.
Where did Carl go to school?
Carl went to Whiteman School, right in the next block, when there was a Whiteman School. And then he went to Taylor Alderdice High School. And then to Bucknell University for 1 year. And then the other 3 years of undergraduate at the Wharton School of Finance at the University of Pennsylvania and University of Pittsburgh Law School.
Did he do anything of exceptional note during his grade school and high school years?
He was the scholars program at Taylor Alderdice. I can't remember. Oh, not particularly at school, but when he was a young man, he was a terrific baseball player. His father, by the way, was a great baseball player as a young man until he got too old and fat to do it. But Carl was a little league and a marvelous pitcher, and that was his big claim to fame when he was a young man.
Does he participate in baseball now at all?
I think his law firm, I'm not sure whether they still have a baseball team. There's some, yes, I think they do. I think that they have, that the different law firms have teams and they have matches. Yeah, they do. I think he still does that. I'm not sure.
You mentioned your family vacations in Chautauqua. Was this meant then that Sydney was not working during the summer?
The Pittsburgh Symphony was not in session at that time. Mm-hmm. There was no work there because it was only a short season. But there was a Chautauqua Symphony Orchestra, and he played in the Chautauqua Symphony. And that season was about 6 weeks, so that brought us to Chautauqua. When we first started to go there, which was the first year after we were married, I was still working for the Pittsburgh Symphony, and we had no child. He would go for the whole season, and I would spend several weeks there.
Could you explain a little bit about what Chautauqua is? I'm familiar with it, but I'm sure there must be plenty of people who aren't.
Well, Chautauqua is a religious and cultural center situated on a lake, a 17-mile lake. Well, not all of them. Chautauqua isn't on all of the whole lake. Started out as a religious center, but now there is a symphony orchestra, there's an opera, there are plays, there are courses, innumerable courses on all kinds of subjects. There's a dance school. The little children go to what they call Boys or Girls Club, which is kind of a day camp arrangement.
Did Carl go there?
Yes, Carl went to all of until he was about 13 years old, which is a great thing. Very reasonable. I haven't gotten to the flavor of Chautauqua, which is the hardest thing to describe. I have been back there every year for 41 years. 41 summers. 1941. It's more than 41 summers. We're in 83. Must be 42 summers. It is where I live in the summertime. That's all I can say.
I want to clarify the point that Chautauqua is in Chautauqua, New York.
Right, yeah. Right, yes. This is a, And it's called Chautauqua Institution, and it has a very unusual legal arrangement. There's a board of directors, and there's a president. Oh, and there's a fence around Chautauqua with gates. You have to buy a gate ticket to get in. It's like, I think going back in history some years, it was built in the days when there were no cars, the streets are narrow and windy, there are many old, old houses. There's a feeling of great peace there. You feel extremely protected. But there's more than that. I don't want to say exactly there's something spiritual, but you just feel like, well, like you just stepped into another world that may be partly heaven. That's all I can say. Is that, will that do it?
Oh, I agree.
Will that do it?
That
it might be
good.
A little piece of heaven. And so I've never said it quite that way, but if I were to describe it, I would. Now, over the years, of course, we had a lot of friends in the orchestra, and after my husband was no longer able to play there, then the orchestra people, those friendships, many of them left also. But then I developed other friends, and so there is, when I go back, it's like going home.
You mentioned that both Sydney and Carl played baseball. Did you as a family have any other hobbies or interests?
Not really. No. Not really. Since he was a professional musician, that was our way of life. And it was hobby, it was work, it was social, it was just involved our whole lives in the wintertime. In the summertime, when we went to Chautauqua, I did my swimming, and Sydney did his golf, fishing before golf. And Carl went to Boys Club, and the setup was such that our recreational activities were just right there. We never had to plan what we were going to do. It was all right there.
Has religion been a big part of your married life?
Not particularly. No, I wouldn't say that. I'm not deeply religious. I go to synagogue from time to time. Sydney was not religious at all. Also, couldn't sit still.
Did Carl go to Sunday school?
Carl went to Sunday school, and Carl was bar mitzvahed.
Where?
And Carl was at Tree of Life, and Carl was confirmed. And,
is Carl married?
No, no, he is not married. Anybody listening have a good Jewish girl for him? I'm interested. I think he is too. No, he's a very successful young man, and he should eventually find the right girl.
Were you, you did mention that you were involved with the symphony all those years working. Did you ever get involved in any type of community organization?
Not really, except the up and down the street, door-to-door collecting. Anybody wanted, you know, you're a young mother, you had a kid, and you walk up and down the street, you collected for everybody. Anybody that needed somebody to do the block, and they called you, you did the block. Whether it was leukemia or Salvation Army, I don't think we did that, Red Cross or whatever, whatever came along. I don't know that I did anything other than that. I did work, even though this was after I was through profession with the symphony, I did work as a volunteer solicitor and helped with season ticket calling and that sort of thing. I did work for them, but that was the only organization. However, I must say that because I was so involved with my husband and his work and my child, that the dimension that I missed being a volunteer in other organizations. I mean, I'd love to have had the sense of working with other people as a volunteer to accomplish something that was worthwhile. And I never quite had the experience, and I guess I never will, but I always wished that I had. I always felt a little bit jealous of women who would get together who had a common interest, like UJF, let's say, or Montefiore, or whatever, and really worked together to accomplish whatever they were interested in. I never had that experience, and I wish that I had.
What other ways do you feel that being married to someone who was in a symphony orchestra differed from being married to someone who was in a 9-to-5 profession?
Well, first of all, you have a lot more togetherness. A lot more, because their schedules are, they can be home a whole day, or half a day, or they can be out in the evenings. I think I did mention before that your whole life revolves around your friends. Our friends were mostly, especially when we were younger, mostly musicians. We branched out as we got older, but mostly when we were younger, it was musicians. Your life was your professional life, and that became your social life.
What happened when the symphony went on tour? Did you go with me?
Oh, yeah, I've been on a number of really good tours. As my husband said, I always went on the expensive trips and never bothered. Well, before Carl was born, I even went on the white and one-night stands, some of them, in this country. But I went to Europe. I went to Japan. I went to the Virgin Islands twice. I guess those were the out-of-country trips that I took.
Did you
went to California? Yes, I had to pay for my own share. Of course, he was taken care of, and doubling up in a room didn't cost that much more. But of course, I had. And some of those trips, they had. They were willing to take the wives at a special rate, mm-hmm. because they had the room on the plane. Now I think that they book them by the seat, and so they can't. And besides, the wives don't allow to go anymore anyway. They don't allow the wives to go. By the orchestra's, the musician's own choice, wives are not allowed to go on the tour. They can go if they go in separate ways, I mean, like a separate plane. Although I'm not sure on the overseas trips whether they're allowed to go. I haven't been on any of the recent ones.
What was it like with Sidney practicing all the time? I assume he did practice at home.
He did practice, but not so much at home. He practiced more in the hall. And
did he teach?
Not at all. He had one pupil. For a while, he was not a teacher. I mean, he was marvelous with this boy. I mean, the boy is supposed to have a half-hour lesson, and 2 hours later, he's still teaching him because he got carried away with him, and he was a very talented boy. But he never sucked.
When did Sidney become personnel manager for the symphony?
I really can't remember, but it had to be in the late 40s.
And what were his
It was before Steinberg came. Well, a personnel manager is sort of a half and half person. He works for the management, and he also has to consider the interests of the musicians. He helps with schedules, he listens to their problems, he sees that they get on the stage on time on tours, he would see that they got to the buses and direct them all. He was the man who was backstage always to see that whatever happened in connection with the musicians was all put together. Contract time, he would, in the early years especially, he would negotiate the contracts, at least help the manager do that. Take the roll, anybody's absent, he'd have to put it down, and he'd make a report to the office at the end of every week as to whether there were any absences and how many rehearsals actually took time, took place, and if there was any overtime or any problems. Lots of little things could turn up. It's very hard to enumerate exactly what.
How did he get this job? Is it appointed or?
It's appointed. They always have had, almost always have had personnel managers from the orchestra. And when there was a need for somebody, he was the one that was asked to do it.
And how many years was he personnel manager?
I think it must have been at least 25 years, 25 to 30 years. As I say, I have all that down, but I don't want to take your time to dig it all out. I have it all down with all kinds of clippings and things. But it's there, and I have to. had a kidney problem, which was discovered when he was quite a young man. But it did not, it was stable and didn't create any problems until, I guess it was about 3 years before he died. And then he slowly got kidney failure and had to go on a dialysis. But that was not the immediate cause of his death. He had some surgery, and his what was required had nothing to do with the kidneys, and the stomach surgery, and that he couldn't survive.
I believe there was something that he participated in. It was written up in the Roto magazine and the Sunday paper about the new wasn't it the new dialysis department at St. Francis Hospital?
Yes. Well, there was one. He was written up in the Erie because wherever we would go, we could always arrange for dialysis near wherever we were. Now, when we were in Chautauqua, the nearest dialysis center was Erie. And they did have an article about him in Erie. And I believe there was one in the Rota section about St. Francis Hospital. That was where the dialysis center was situated at St. Francis. It was not a St. Francis activity. Yes, there was a story written. He had lots of stories written about him. He was very verbal, very appealing man. And I have a whole press book of interviews, and everybody loved to talk to him because he had always these stories of the kinds of things that happened on tour, and he always embellished them. He never told them the same way twice. He always embellished them, and everybody would just, at parties and wherever he told a story, he just always got tremendous attention. But to get back to dialysis, which is a great thing, when he went to Ambler, Pennsylvania, when the symphony played there in the summertime, we also arranged for dialysis at a hospital there. And of course that took a little doing, but I was more determined than he. I mean, I was determined that he was going to live as normal a life as possible. So I guess I brought that up because you asked me about that article.
Right.
But there's lots of stuff written about him. Lots of fun articles with the kinds of things. I still have his viola, which I don't want to dispose of. It's about 300 and, it must be about 320, 330 years old.
Do you know where it's from, the history behind it?
It's from Italy, originally. I've forgotten the name of the maker. I did want to have it played on by somebody in the Pittsburgh Symphony, but I just don't think about it too often. I haven't quite made that arrangement.
How did Sydney come by it?
Well, he heard about this viola, which a musician in Connecticut had. Sydney had a viola that was made, I think, in the U.S. And it was a good viola, but he wanted an old Italian instrument. And he heard about this instrument. And at that time, it was affordable. Now it wouldn't be. It's gone up so much in value. But at that time it was affordable, and he negotiated for it. And at that time the instruments were not, violas were always hard to get. But at that time instruments were not quite as expensive as they are now, nor were they as scarce. Now there are lots of people, like me, who have instruments that are not even being played on. I feel badly about that, and I really mean to do something about it eventually. I don't want to part with it.
You mentioned before we started doing this oral history program that this coming year, I believe you said, will be your 50th
year in the music business.
In the music
I started
business.
In 1934 with the Pittsburgh Symphony.
All right, and I'd like now to get into your present project, which I assume you started after the Pittsburgh Symphony, the Gateway to Music.
Well, my husband was really the... he came into Gateway to Music the second year after, just at the end of the first year after it was organized, and that was in 1957. He was a violist and also became the manager. I did all the office was in our home, and I did all the bookkeeping and clerical and typing work that he needed because I had all those skills and experience.
Can you give me a little bit of the history of the development and the Gateway to Music.
Well, Gateway to Music is an organization that has various performing groups that play for children in the schools. It's meant to be educational as well as entertaining. And the musicians perform and they talk about their instruments and children ask questions. And it's generally, there's a lot of give and take with the children. It started out with just a string quartet. And there was a violinist whose name was Bess Kessler, now Simon, who really started it. And she was in the first quartet. It started out with just a string quartet, and then eventually they added a brass quintet and a woodwind quintet. And then I think the next group was a percussion ensemble. By the way, I have some brochures, which I brought for both of you to have.
Okay.
And what came after percussion? Then, I guess, the ballet, Pittsburgh Ballet Theater. And then a jazz quintet.